This is VSiN's College Football Betting Podcast.
Welcome in another edition of the VSiN College Football Betting Podcast. I am your host, Tim Murray. Fired up for today. We're going to do a shorter open because we have two guests on the podcast today. We're going to do a deep dive on the SEC with Cole Kubelik of the SEC Network. He also hosts a daily radio show in Birmingham with Greg McElroy. Got to be a fun dynamic down there with former Alabama quarterback and former Auburn offensive lineman. And also, he has a YouTube show as well. So he is a very busy man, and we did a really fun deep dive on the SEC. I mean, it's wild when you look at that conference and the depth that it has this year. We couldn't get to every program. He's a busy man. I could only talk to him for, you know, so long, but really fun stuff, good stuff to chat with him. And then after that, going to bring on Kelly Ford. Kelly Ford is not a gambler, but he makes his own power ratings, and I wanted to bring him on, kind of get the breakdown of how he goes into making his power ratings, how they compare to the Vegas odds. Is there a big discrepancy between some of his numbers and what is out there in the marketplace? And once again, he's not a gambler. So it was a fun conversation, a little bit of a deep dive. Hopefully you guys enjoy that as well as we went all over the map with Kelly Ford, who once again does a phenomenal job of making his own power ratings and comparing them to the market. He's pretty spot on. So hopefully you guys enjoy that conversation. Please, as always, rate, review, and subscribe. Keeping true to my word, aren't I? Keeping it every week, at least one into your feed. I'm looking forward to the month of July. Haven't gotten all of the specifics figured out just yet, but we'll have Big 12 Media Day here in Las Vegas at Allegiant Stadium. Mountain West Media Day will be at Circa. So a bunch of those folks will be jumping on VSiN Primetime, whether it be new head coach of Boise State, hopefully, Spencer Danielson, etc. So looking forward to that in the middle of July. Next week, I'm going to do a deep dive on the Heisman Trophy. I'm going to look at history, look at all the odds. Does the expanded playoff allow us, the better, to maybe go a little bit deeper into those odds bank? And you enter this year with the favorite, Carson Beck, being 8-1. So it's not like he is plus 200 or something like that as we enter this year. So I think the Heisman race this year with the expanded playoff is going to be fascinating and a pretty wide open Heisman race, in my opinion. I want to do a couple quick things before we head into Cole Kubelik, who joins us. How about this? So Cole's down there in Birmingham, and it's a new era in Alabama. Nick Saban is out. Kalen DeBoer is in. First time since 2007 that there will be a new person roaming the sidelines. And I was looking at some of the game of the year lines. September 28th, Alabama hosts Georgia, and right now at Circa, Georgia is a 5-point favorite. At DraftKings, Georgia is a 4.5-point favorite. I want you to ask yourself right now, how many times do you think Alabama has been a home underdog since 2008? All right, you think about that. We'll do the Jeopardy music. Zero. They have not been a home underdog since 2007, year one of the Nick Saban era. That is absolutely unbelievable, the sustained success that this program has had year after year. It's unfathomable to think about that they have not been a home underdog since George W. Bush was the president of the United States. November 3rd, 2007 was the last time Alabama was a home underdog. Could it change? It's possible, but I would say pretty unlikely unless Carson Beck were to get hurt. This Georgia team is loaded. We'll discuss it with Cole, but I went back and I just started thinking, when was the last time they were a home underdog? And I looked up back to 2008, because that's when they got things rolling, right? 2007, year one of Nick Saban. They went 6-6. I think they lost to UL Monroe. November 3rd, 2007, the last time Alabama was a home underdog. It was a push, by the way, on the closing number, LSU plus 7, or Alabama plus 7, I beg your pardon, and they lost 41-34. Since 2008, Alabama 104-6 straight up at Bryant-Denny Stadium. Just absolutely unbelievable to think about, and I can't wait for September 28th. That game is going to be a lot of fun. By the way, both teams, Alabama and Georgia, will be coming off of a bye there to go into that game. And for Georgia, no one's going to cry over their schedule, but they have one of the toughest schedules in the country. It's not Florida-esque, but you open up neutral site against Clemson. Oh, by the way, no big deal, just a 13.5-point favorite. Then you're at Alabama September 28th. You're at Texas October 19th. You're at Ole Miss November 9th. Georgia plays the top three teams outside of themselves all on the road this year in the SEC. But don't worry, they're still a favorite in every single game. Only right now in the look-ahead line in the game of the year lines, a two-point favorite at Texas. They're a touchdown favorite against Ole Miss. And Georgia still has to play Tennessee at home. Road trip to Kentucky last year. Wasn't it Kentucky who gave them a little bit of a scare? No, it was not. They absolutely destroyed Kentucky last year. It was Auburn who gave them a scare last year. But before we get to Cole, I want to run through this real quick, because the first question I asked Cole after we discuss a colleague of mine at VSiN, Stormy. What's up, Stormy? I know you shared a sideline at times. I guess you guys were on opposite sidelines with the USFL. But how many SEC teams enter this year with realistic expectations of going to the college football playoff? How many teams will be disappointed if they don't make the college football playoff? Like, I know Clark Lee last year at SEC Media Days said, Vanderbilt's coming, and then he went 2-10. Hey, you got Diego Pavia from New Mexico State. Jerry Kill's on your staff now. Hopefully you win a couple games. But no Vanderbilt fan is going to be upset if Vanderbilt does not make the playoff. They will be doing cartwheels in Nashville if they make it to a bowl game, which they more than likely won't. So how many teams realistically can say, we are anticipating getting to the college football playoff? Well, looking at the odds, there are four teams right now that are favored to make the playoff at DraftKings. The yes-no market up at DraftKings. Georgia, no surprise, minus 550 to make the playoff. Texas, minus 250 to make the playoff. Ole Miss, minus 130 to make the playoff. And LSU, a team we don't even talk about with Cole. There's that loaded of a conference. LSU, year three of the Brian Kelly family era down there in Baton Rouge. And they're a minus 110 to make it to the college football play. It's essentially a pick 'em there with LSU, but they do lose Jaden Daniels. Ever heard of him? He was pretty good. They lose Malik Nabers. They lose Brian Thomas. They lose their offensive coordinator. But LSU, at DraftKings, minus 110 to make the playoffs, minus 120 to miss the playoffs. And then how about short favor or short dogs? Let's look at Missouri, plus 175. Missouri's schedule is so advantageous. You look at Florida, which is the number one most difficult schedule based off of anyone you talk to who has strength of schedule ratings. Missouri, per Phil Steele, has the 62nd most difficult schedule. Out of the chute, Murray State, Buffalo, Boston College, Vanderbilt at home. You're 4-0 heading into a bye week. You go to Texas A&M. That'll be a challenge. Then you're home to UMass. Home to Auburn. Wait, are you really on the road? How is, am I reading this right? Is Missouri really going to UMass this year? That is the great, who should get fired for that? They are going up to Amherst, Massachusetts. That is bizarre. Well, good for UMass there. But regardless, I don't really think too much about the home field advantage there for UMass. But schedule's certainly manageable for Eli Drinkwitz's squad. Year five of Eli Drinkwitz. All right, keep it rolling. Tennessee, plus 180 to make the playoff. Texas A&M, Parker Fleming was on the program just a couple weeks ago and said, I like Texas A&M. Not a crazy thing to look at them to make the college football playoff. Oh, yeah, I skipped Alabama. Even money. So you're looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 teams who are either a favorite to make the college football playoff or as short as plus 220. The long shot, if you want to say that, Oklahoma, the newbie, at plus 450. This conference is absolutely loaded, and we will see how many teams will make the college football playoff. Once again, 12 teams make it. You've got five auto bids. That includes one SEC team. How many of the seven at-larges go to the SEC? The Big Ten is going to be loaded. The Big 12, I would be surprised if they get anyone in else other than their champion. Notre Dame is a favorite, minus 165 to make the playoff. The ACC, could you have two teams from there make it to the college football playoff? There are going to be a lot of disappointed folks cheering for the SEC when it comes playoff time. I'm trying to think of a fair number. Is it over under 4.5 for the SEC to make it into the college football playoff? Once again, we know that they'll get one. We know that for sure. Could they get four of the seven at-large spots? I think it's possible. I really do. I think it's possible, and it's going to come up to the committee how they rate it. Because let's not forget, in the Big Ten, you've got Oregon and Ohio State. Both are massive favorites to make the college football playoff. You've got Penn State, who is certainly going to be in the mix. You've got Michigan, who just won the national championship. They're certainly going to be in the mix for the college football playoff. It is going to be very, very interesting to take a look at how this all plays out with teams to make the college football playoff from the two big boys. And then you look at the rest of the country. I mean, Florida State's plus 130 to make the college football playoff. Clemson is plus 185 to make the college football playoff. This is going to be so fascinating as we look at all of this heading into this year. Hell, USC, part of the Big Ten now. They're 4-1 to make the college football playoff. It's going to be a lot of fun, man. I know people say, oh, it's watering down college football. I disagree. I think the 12-team playoff is going to make things so fascinating heading into that third weekend of December. Cole Kubelik up next. Then we will talk to Kelly Ford, who makes his own power ratings, kfordratings.com. We got a loaded up podcast for you. Hope you enjoy it. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Next week, Tyler Shoemaker, the T-Shoe Index, is out now. He's going to jump on to talk about his power ratings and what differences he has versus the Vegas odds makers. Are there some edges to be had? And also a deep dive on the Heisman Trophy. Cole Kubelik, he's up next right here on the VSiN College Football Betting Podcast. And as promised, Cole Kubelik joining us here to talk a whole lot about the SEC and maybe more importantly, working with my colleague Stormy Bonatoni, what that had to be like. But Cole, really appreciate you jumping on. Obviously, all over the place, SEC Network, Cube Show on YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts. McElroy and Kubelik on WJOX in Birmingham, mornings 7 to 10 a.m. Central Time. But let's start with the pressing question. How was it sharing a sideline with my colleague, Stormy Bonatoni? I was fortunate enough once, Cole, to share the sideline with her for the Las Vegas Bowl this most recent December. How was it working with Stormy?
It was fantastic. She was great. She did a great job. We did not share a sideline. We were across from each other in the games that we did because we would kind of take one side or the other. But I learned a lot more about gambling. It's not something I'm extremely educated on. So it was cool listening to her and kind of her input on it. And she just has a great attitude. It's fun to be around. So, I mean, she made showing up to the games and doing the games more fun and made them more enjoyable. And hopefully we'll be on the same crew again next year.
Yeah, she's awesome. Love working with her. But let's get down to it. You host a show in Birmingham, so it's football season all day, every day. And I'll start with this, because you look at, you know, Bill Conley's S&P Plus post-spring, power ratings, whatever it may be. Cole, as we run through the SEC with an expanded playoff this year, how many teams have a realistic shot, in your opinion, of making the college football playoff this year from the SEC?
I'll give you Alabama, Georgia, LSU, Missouri, probably Tennessee, Ole Miss, So realistic shot, I would say maybe 7.
Okay.
I don't know about a lot of long shot teams. Like I think Florida's going to be better than people think. I think Kentucky's still going to be a solid football team. I think there are some dangerous aspects about Texas A&M. Could everything come together that those teams would need to be in the playoff? No, I don't really think so. There are a lot of reasons I could make an argument that Tennessee will get in. Same for Missouri. LSU probably would be on the bottom end of those teams that I gave you. Ole Miss would be a little bit ahead of them. Ole Miss probably right under Georgia. Alabama probably right there with Ole Miss. I think Georgia's probably in. I think the rest of those teams probably on very similar levels of could they get in. I think Texas is a team that could also get in, and I think Oklahoma is a team that could get in. Actually, I don't think those two teams are very different going into this season. I think the schedules are probably the big separator between Texas and Oklahoma. You're one in the SEC. Oklahoma is just a little bit more brutal. But those are two other teams that obviously I got to start forcing myself to remember that I absolutely think are good enough to be able to find their way into the college football playoff.
Yeah, Oklahoma, based off of Bill Conley, your colleague at ESPN, 15th in his updated S&P Plus heading into this year. Let's do a deep dive here on Alabama, because I can only imagine what this offseason has been like for you and Greg McElroy on your program there, because for the first time in, a decade plus, no Nick Saban roaming the sidelines there for the Crimson Tide. Enter Kalen DeBoer, who obviously was phenomenal at his stop there at Washington. Let's start with the coaching staff and how big. Well, let's start with Kalen DeBoer. What's your expectations? What's the feel? What have your listeners been saying about Kalen DeBoer as they get ready for year one?
I think from a listener standpoint, an Alabama fan standpoint, a lot of it was wait and see, just because they didn't know a lot about him, weren't really educated on who he was, what he had done. Greg and I were both really excited about the hire because we both like Kalen a lot and think he's a great football coach and just love the person that he is also. I've had a chance to be around him a lot the last 2 years. I had the Alamo Bowl 2 years ago, had the Sugar Bowl this year, took the Joe Moore Award out there this past year. So I thought it was a home run hire for Alabama. You're not going to replace Nick Saban. You're not going to get the next Saban or another Saban. He's one of a kind, and I think you got a great football coach. And he's already showing in recruiting that part's not going to take too big of a drop with Nick Saban and his staff being out. You get a couple holdovers like Freddie Roach coaching that defensive line, so they'll have a feel of the strength coach David Ballou. Those guys going to stay in. I think that helps keep a little bit of the continuity left over from the success that Saban had. But I like the new staff that's in place. I mean, you go get Maurice Lynquist, who was a head coach at Buffalo. You go get Kane Womack, who's a head coach at South Alabama. I love the fact you bring in extra coaches that have legitimate collegiate head coaching experience. That's just more guys you can bounce things off of, more guys you can have real conversations with. So I think you put a good staff together. I think he's a great head coach. Some people might look at offensive coordinator and say, it's not the name that a lot of people would have wanted or thought, but they've been together for a long time. And hell, Kalen can call it if he needs to, and he'd be great doing it. So I expect them to be in the mix for the college football playoff this year. There's just a few areas I have concerns with, offensive tackle being one, mainly pass rusher being two. We haven't seen that proven pass rusher on that defense right now. Depth at linebacker being three. And then a little bit of concern about Milroe in that system. He'll be asked to do a lot more through the air. We'll see how that goes. I think he can be one of the better quarterbacks in the nation, but this will be a little bit different ask from him than what he's been the last couple of years.
Yeah, when you look at this roster construction, Jalen Milroe, as you alluded to, back, but a lot of pieces leaving via the transfer portal. The schedule is one of the toughest in the country. Phil Steele puts it at number 9. You go on the road to Wisconsin. You're home to Georgia, at Tennessee, third weekend in October. Home to Missouri, at LSU, at Oklahoma. So you look at some of those point spreads. I was looking back because I couldn't remember, Cole, the last time Alabama was a home underdog. You got to go back to year one for Nick Saban. 2007 was the last time that Alabama was a home underdog, and they're going to be a home underdog against Georgia at the end of September there. So when you look at roster construction, schedule, the win total's 9.5. Are you anticipating 10 wins? I mean, because now in Tuscaloosa, in your neck of the woods down in Alabama, if you're not winning double-digit games there for the Crimson Tide, it's going to be a nuclear meltdown.
honestly, 10 would have been a problem, and has been 1 or 2 years. We haven't seen that very much. I think it's very possible. I still think you're going to have a good defensive line, maybe not dominant. Tim Smith played a lot of football. Tim Keenan played well last year. You got Jihad Campbell, Deontay Lawson at linebacker, one of the best tandems in the SEC. I don't love the depth behind that. Jaheim Otis is a guy that I think could have a breakout year up front in front of them. You've got a lot of new faces on the back end of the defense, like Keon Sabb from Michigan, Damani Jackson from USC, Zabian Brown's a freshman that'll probably play, but Malachi Moore has played a lot of football, can play every position back there, and Kane Womack brings a little bit of a new style on defense that I think could be beneficial for those guys. I love the middle of the offensive line. It's just the tackle position I'm a little bit concerned about. But you got a good group of tight ends that could offset that a little bit. Jam Miller, Justice Haynes should be fine at tailback. Jeremy Bernard, a big get from Washington at receiver. Talent-wise, they're going to be fine. They're not going to play too many teams. They're just going to have more guys than they do. It's just getting on the same page, continuity, finding rhythm in what they're being asked to do offensively. I think they'll be a little bit more of a physical team, more of a run-first team than maybe some people are expecting just because they saw Penix numbers from last year. Alabama doesn't have those kind of receivers. They got some good receivers, but they're not going to have what Washington had last year. So I still think they're in the mix. I think they're in the hunt. You know, you mentioned the Georgia game. Yeah, they might be an underdog, but that's at home. That's a tough place to win. And we've seen how that matchup has gone the last couple of times they've played.
Yeah, and flipping to Georgia, who is the favorite to win the national championship this year, them and Ohio State seem to be, Cole, kind of based off of the odds in a ballpark onto their own. You've got Carson Beck, who's the Heisman favorite coming into this year, 8-1. You've got to replace Brock Bowers, Ladd McConkey, but you go to the portal, you bring in ETN from Florida. I love Benjamin Urosick that they got from Stanford. He's an absolute beast that they bring in to pair him with Oscar Delp. So the weapons are no concern. They go out and they get Colby Young as well. So they got pieces, no doubt about it. When you look at Georgia, the schedule's brutal, but it's Georgia, and no one's going to cry over, you know, their schedule strength. Let's try to poke holes first. What are the holes, in your opinion, of this Georgia roster that looks stacked from 1 to 85?
It's much more nitpicking here than when we talk about some other teams like Xavier Truss at tackle. When Amaris Mims went out of the game last year, they were different at that position. You got a couple of guys you're going to replace up front, but Ernest Green should be fine over on the left side. You get Jared Wilson in at center, who physically is probably much more capable than Cedric Van Pran, who they've had, but mentally and emotionally, we just don't know yet if he can handle it all the way that Cedric did. You're not going to be the same at tight end. And I'm with you, and I heard great things about Urosick in spring practice and what he did and what they think of him and what he's going to be. But you don't have a Brock Bowers, which was the ultimate get-out-of-jail-free card. He's like, you know, the ultimate just, you know, wild card of where he's going to line up, where he's going to get the ball, what he's going to do when you need him. But you mentioned the weapons, and it's something that I don't think people really have a true grasp of. I mean, Ra-Ra Thomas is a legit number one receiver in this league. Dominic Lovett is a number one slot in this league. Dylan Bell is a flex player that can be now at tailback in the slot. You can move him around. You bring in Colby Young from Miami. Aaron Smith is an absolute burner who can take the top off. Not a lot of teams have a guy that can run the way that he can. And you get Vanderbilt's number two receiver in London Humphreys that could come in and play the slot and do some different things. Like, the receiving corps out of this world. You didn't even mention Lawson Lucky at tight end. They also think Jalen Riddell could come in and maybe play some tight end for him this year, but probably not going to have to. Roderick Robinson's been banged up at tailback. Branson Robinson will be there at running back with ATN. That position should be a little bit better. I think Michael Williams could have a breakout year at defensive end. Two starting linebackers return. You get a starting safety back in Malachi Starks. Like, there's not a lot of holes that you can poke in it. Is the defensive line as dominant as it was 3 years ago? No, it's not going to be. But that's probably the best defensive line we've seen in the history of college football. Corner, as good as last year? Maybe not. Secondary in general, altogether, probably not the same. But I still have confidence it's going to be pretty good. So I think maybe you look at tackle, you look at offensive line continuity, you look at certain portions of the defense, like maybe not being as dominant up front or not having the continuity you did last year in the secondary, but it's nitpicky, man, when you're trying to pick apart this Georgia football team.
How good is Carson Beck and how good can he be?
I think he can be the number one pick in the draft. I mean, he's got that kind of arm talent. My understanding is the way that he's handled himself this offseason has been trying to develop more as a leader, be more vocal, doing everything that everybody's asked of him, the conditioning. He's been first in line a majority of the time. Like he's coming around as being that guy at that position. It's one thing to have the talent and be there, but mentally, emotionally, you know, handling yourself in that presidential way is what I hear Carson Beck has been doing this offseason. So I think number one overall is absolutely in reach for Carson Beck. There were people I talked to that thought if he came out last year, he'd be a top 10 pick. So he's got all the ability. He can make every single throw. He's got great command, and he'll have the weapons to have one hell of a season. If they protect him, I mean, he's going to be in New York. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
October 19th, Georgia goes to Austin, and that's going to take some time getting used to, I'm sure, for you, especially working for the SEC Network and working down there in Birmingham for that to be a conference game. But you look at preseason prognostications, Cole, it's Georgia, Ohio State, Oregon, Texas, all lumped in that kind of same ballpark of these teams are going to win a national championship or have a chance to do so. So Texas, maybe a little bit newer to you to do the deep dive on, but Quinn Ewers is back. They obviously lost Xavier Worthy, who gets drafted by the Kansas City Chiefs, A.D. Mitchell, Jatavion Sanders, but they were busy in the portal. They bring in Isaiah Bond, the burner from Alabama, Silas Bolden from Oregon State. For those of you who stayed up late, he's a stud as well. Texas is getting a lot of hype, a lot of preseason love. Week two trip to the Big House should be a fun one against Michigan. What do you make of this Texas team? Are they as good as people expect them to be, which is around third or fourth in national championship odds?
Yeah, I think that's where they should be. I think tier one is probably Georgia and Ohio State, and tier two, Texas is in that mix. And that group, probably not more than four, probably fewer than four teams for me. You mentioned quarterback, and it's not just Quinn Ewers, but Arch Manning sitting there. Your quarterback room is in good shape. Very few teams can lose a quarterback for a series, a game, a three-game stretch, and have somebody like Arch that can come in and be able to manage that thing, and I think he'd be able to. Offensive line should be one of the best in college football. Everybody coming back. Kelvin Banks will be a first-round pick at left tackle. I don't think many teams did as good of a job replacing the important pieces that they lost than Texas did. I mean, you mentioned it. You lose an absolute burner, but you bring in Isaiah Bond at wide receiver. Matthew Golden's a legitimate slot wide receiver. And then you lose Jatavion Sanders at tight end. Well, what do? You go to Alabama and get Amari Nyeblack, a guy that's run 22 miles per hour on the GPS. You weren't great off the edge last year, so you go get Trey Moore from UTSA, and you put him across from Baron Sorrell that's going to be coming back. Now, you weren't going to replace what you had inside last year. You just weren't defensively. Like, that will not be the same. And I think that's probably what I'm most interested in is you take those two big war daddies inside and you go get a Bill Norton from Arizona who's really good. That was at Georgia once before. I saw him at Arizona a couple of times last year. And Tialali Savea, I think, are two guys that at least give you similar body types. But they're not going to be the same kind of players. So what does that do to the secondary, which wasn't great last year for Texas? That's my biggest concern is can they get to the quarterback at a higher rate, and can that secondary just flat be better in coverage? Because that was probably the biggest liability on that football team. I'm not worried about the offense with Sark calling plays. You got C.J. Baxter, Jaden Blewett running back. You'll be fine there. I think you're solid at linebacker again, even though you lose a really good one from last year's defense. I think this will come down to physicality. Can it be similar to what it was or better than it was last year? And can they stay healthy? If they do, then Texas is going to be in the mix for a college football playoff berth as well.
Ole Miss, this is a team, Cole, that is getting a lot of love. I've talked about them a bunch on this podcast, certainly. Coming off an 11-2 year, they bring back a ton. Yeah. They go to the portal based off of 247, number one in the portal rankings. It is an all-in type of season, it feels like, for the Lane train down there. You do have to go to, you know, Death Valley October 12th. No Alabama, but you host Georgia. I can only imagine what that's going to be like in Oxford on November 9th when Georgia rolls into town. The hype is there for Lane squad entering this year. Jackson Dart is talked about in the Heisman conversations. Are you buying in on the Ole Miss hype this season?
Yeah, absolutely. They have, outside of maybe Missouri, and you could put them neck and neck, Ole Miss probably a little bit of a smoother runway into their season. Those are the two teams that you look at and say, wow, what a way to get off to a clean start, play four or five games, and then get into the meat of your schedule. You know exactly what you are, who you can lean on, who you can rely on. And part of that number one portal class ranking is going to depend on who is available. Juice Wells, I thought, was the best receiver in the SEC going into last season. Now, he had the foot issue. He wasn't very healthy. just go watch the Georgia tape when he only plays like two or three series, and you'll see what he's capable of against one of the better defenses in college football. He can be a legit number one. You already have a legit number one in Trey Harris, who transferred in from La Tech last year and is as big of a big-time outside receiver as you're going to get. Jordan Watkins has been in that offense. Last year, they would have told you that Aiden Williams was going to be the breakout freshman at wide receiver. They will not be short of weapons in that offense, specifically with Caden Priestcorn, who's the big difference maker at tight end. Somebody who can stretch the field a little bit. I'm not going to say he's super twitchy and super fast, but like he's got enough of that. But he'll get in there next to the tackle, and he'll grind out some blocks as well, which is one of the reasons I love him. They go get Diego Pounds from North Carolina, Nate Kalepo from Washington on that offensive line, which has not been super physical the last few years. And those are big, real physical bodies. They haven't had a guy like Kalepo that can do the things he can do in quite some time. Julius Below from Washington also comes in to help that offensive line. They got good depth back there. Like Caleb Warren has played. Jeremy James has played. Micah Pettis has played. They, for the first time since I can remember, have two, three guys in the second group of their offensive line that I've actually seen play football, that I know won't be a complete liability when they come into the game. And the other side of that is they've upgraded what they've needed to on defense. Length was a big problem for Pete Golding. Physicality, just bodies up front on defense. And now J.J. Pegues has become a better defensive lineman every year. Walter Nolan has played in this league. Xavier Harris can play. They got more out of Akilo Stone last year than I thought they would. Jared Ivey back on the edge. And you get somebody with real twitch like Princely Umanilayan from Florida that, again, they haven't probably had since Hugh Freeze was there. So there's no reason not to think that defense is not going to take another step. Not putting them in the top 20 yet, but the way they're going to score, hell, they don't need a top 20 defense. They need a top 50 defense, and they're going to be in almost every game they play. This will come down to brute force and strength. When they play teams like Georgia, how are they going to hold up? Because that's still been the question for a long time. And I think that'll be the question here. They also have a couple tricky ones late, like Florida. I think, like I told you, I think Florida's going to be better than people think. How beat up will Ole Miss be late? Because there are a few spots which you look at the depth and say, meh, I don't know how much I love it there. Like running back's not going to be one of those spots because they have seven who've played. But there are a couple other spots. I mean, quarterback, they're even deep there. So there's really no reason that this team should not be in the college football playoff this year.
Yeah, nice little pickup there from the portal late to get Rashad Amos, who I think, Mississippi State, then to Colorado, and then ultimately landed at Ole Miss, but he was really good. All right, you mentioned it a couple times, Cole. Let's get to Florida. I talked about it to wrap up the last podcast. Just a brutal schedule. You talk about a non-con of Miami, UCF, and Florida State. Everybody from the SEC, it seems like, is on that schedule, maybe outside of Alabama, but Billy Napier, I joked and said, if he could get the bowl eligibility, forget getting fired. This guy should be SEC Coach of the Year. So you've talked about it a couple times on different platforms. You're higher on Florida just from a talent standpoint. The schedule is a gauntlet. What do we expect from the Gators in year three of the Napier era?
I'll start with this. The schedule is going to be tough, but I do think that there's a little bit of logo fever happening with this schedule. Could Miami be really good this year? Yeah, they could. Cam Ward might fit right in. But Cam Ward is also like an N1 point guard a lot of the time. Like he's just running around waiting for something to happen before he tries and goes and makes a play. Miami went 7-6 last year. UCF went 6-7 last year. Under normal circumstances, those are not scary games. But for some reason, a lot of folks this offseason have convinced themselves that those are insurmountable walls that Florida's just not going to be able to get over. Florida State, different deal. They were a great football team last year. We saw the bowl game when what's going to be gone and then some more, what they looked like. Doesn't mean they won't be good again this year. I just don't know. I know I'm not rolling all my eggs in the DJ Uiagalelei basket as for them to be what they were a season ago with Jordan Travis. So that one might be totally different than people suspect. I think the offensive line is going to be better. I think they're really good at tailback, and not a lot of people know it. I love Montrell Johnson. I think he's a grinder. He's not super dynamic, but he's going to get you positive yards. And I think Jaden Baugh, has a chance to be a breakout star at tailback for Florida this year. Do you need other weapons at receiver? Yes, Eugene Wilson can be that guy. But I know they just got one from Arizona State that I think is going to be able to come in and potentially be that guy. So you've upgraded a little bit there, and potentially that's going to be enough for – if you took Graham Mertz's numbers and put them on any other quarterback in the SEC and we talked about what they were going to be coming back, we'd be talking about 10 or 11 wins. I mean, it's just people, for whatever reason, and this actually started, in my opinion, two spring games ago. But you remember, Austin Armstrong was just hired. He came in there and threw the kitchen sink at him. Like, three offensive linemen were held out of that game. He had to throw the ball away half the time. He was taking sacks left and right. Patchwork offensive line. But he goes out and goes 73%, almost 3,000 yards, 20 touchdowns, three picks last year. And people still talk about him like he's terrible. And I just don't think he's terrible. The defense can't be any worse than it was last year. You go get Austin Armstrong's mentor. You bring him in as co-DC. I think that's going to help. Cam Jackson's a stud up front on that defense. Caleb Banks going to be a really good defensive lineman. I just think when you look at what they can be at the line of scrimmage, that's going to be better than people think. And the offense is designed to be very quarterback-friendly, and you have a quarterback that can operate at a high level. He's already proven that and shown that. So I think maybe a little bit overemphasis on the teams they're playing, a lot of underemphasis on what Florida maybe is and has, is going to lead to them exceeding expectations. Now, to be fair, a lot of these expectations are 3 and 4 wins. Mm-hmm. So I'm with you. 6 would still be a pretty good season. I think 7, maybe 8 is still possible, because not every team can be great. Like, not every team in college football is going to be awesome. They're just not. And we look at the Florida schedule and we just like, every team is going to be incredible. It's not going to happen that way.
All right, two more before I let you run, Cole, because you're a busy man, so I don't want to take up too much of your time. You mentioned Missouri. They're the opposite of Florida from a schedule standpoint, where you got no Georgia, no Texas, no LSU, no Ole Miss. You do have a road trip to Alabama. Missouri brings back a lot of production. Brady Cook is back. Luther Burden's an absolute superstar at wide receiver. Cody Schrader, what a great story. He goes out. They bring in Nate Noel from Appalachian State. Eli Drinkwitz's squad that went to a New Year's Six last year, they should be 4-0 walking into a bye week and then headed to Kyle Field. Realistic expectations for Mizzou this year in Columbia?
Should go into November with a realistic spot to make the playoff. Even if you drop that game at Alabama on October the 26th, Kyle Field's going to be tough on October the 5th. I get it. You get Auburn at home. That's an early kick. I don't love that one. You get Oklahoma at home, at Mississippi State and South Carolina. They're more talented than those teams right now. They just are. You should get those wins. And you're more talented than Arkansas. You should get that one. So really, I mean, you're looking at October, and the first week in November decides your season if you're Missouri. Because like you said, you should be 5-0 heading to that game at Kyle Field, at UMass. You're good. Auburn early, that takes a little bit of the home field advantage away. And then you're at Alabama, Oklahoma at home. How you fare in those games is going to decide whether or not you're in or out of the college football playoff, in my opinion. I like this team a lot. I understand Blake Baker's gone. He was great for that defense. He's going to help LSU's defense. They're not going to be exactly the same up front, but Chris McClellan played a lot at Florida up front on defense. Zion Young, I've seen his film. He's played a lot of college football. Johnny Walker was there last year. He's played. And then on offense, now the secondary is what I might be most concerned with, because that group was really good last year. Like, they attacked the football. They were not afraid to tackle. They need a similar group. And Toriano Pride from Clemson probably has to come in and be one of those guys. But offensively, here's one part of Missouri that I love that I don't hear anybody talking about. Remember at this point last year, it was a three-headed race at quarterback going into the season. Brady Cook didn't even start the first few games. Like, Eli let a couple of other guys play and start to kind of see what was going to happen. Brady Cook got booed earlier in the season. Now he's back. He has all those weapons back that you mentioned. Theo East on the outside, Mookie Cooper in the slot, Luther Burden all over the place. And Nate Noel, yes, he's been running the stretch play at App for what feels like about 8 years. But Marcus Carroll is a bigger, more physical back from Georgia State who had like 1,800 yards last year. He's got tree trunks for quads. He's going to be solid in that system. So you have a quarterback with mobility, a two-headed monster at running back. You go get Marcus Bryant or Caden Green from Oklahoma to fill in for Javon Foster, who you lost at tackle. Armand Membo is going to be one of the best right tackles in college football. I love Brett Norfleet at tight end. He is a mauler. There's no reason this team can't operate at a similar or higher level than they did offensively. And if they're operating at a better level on offense, the defense doesn't quite need to be where it was. And I think they have one of the most underrated play callers in college. Kirby Moore does not get the credit he deserves as a play caller and play designer. And even if they have a down game from Brady Cook here and there, I think that's going to be able to get them out of it. So Missouri should be playing for a spot in the playoff.
Missouri plus 175 to make the playoff. All right, Cole, final one for me. We look up in early November, and one of these teams is playing much better than we expected. South Carolina, Kentucky, Auburn, Arkansas, Mississippi State, Vanderbilt. Which one of the perceived cellar dwellers of the SEC are you expecting more things from this year than the masses?
I'll give you two of those. Auburn is going to be better than people think. Once again, I think most people are saying like six wins. I think they get past that. Cam Coleman is going to be a big-time freshman wide receiver. Keandre Lambert-Smith comes in from Penn State. He was better than anything they had at wide receiver last year. Robert Lewis, while I was watching Marcus Carroll at Georgia State, I also watched his film. He's a nice catch-and-run guy that'll work the middle of the field, that is somebody that Auburn also didn't really have last year. And Sam Jackson was a quarterback at Cal who wasn't full go in the spring that I heard great things about playing wide receiver. You're loaded at running back with Jarquez Hunter, who arguably might be the best running back in the SEC going into the season, but nobody wants to talk about him that way. Damari Alston, Jeremiah Cobb, they've both played in this system, so they're going to be back. Dylan Wade will bump down to guard. I love Connor Lewis center. He's going to be a great football player. Jeremiah Wright is a mauler at the other guard. It took him a little time to kind of catch up with the system, but he's going to be ready this year. Tackle, not super confident in Percy Lewis from Mississippi State. A lot of people just think he's a plug-and-go great player. He's got a ways to go. Xavier Miller's played at the other spot. Rivaldo Fairweather was the lone option for Peyton Thorne last year. These kids could not separate. They could not make contested catches. They did nothing to help their quarterback last year. That's going to be different this year. And Peyton Thorne showed us last year. He's got some wheels. So they'll have that part of the offense to be able to force you to defend. I don't think Peyton Thorne has to have Joe Burrow numbers. If Peyton Thorne can have close to some of those numbers that we mentioned that Graham Mertz had last year, from a completion percentage and not turning the ball over, add a few more with his legs, the Auburn offense will be better. I'm actually worried about the Auburn defense. I don't think that they're big and stout up front. I think linebacker will be fine. Secondary will be okay. I'm a little worried about the defensive line and what that's going to look like, what that's going to be. But you bring in a defensive coordinator who's been in this league for a while that knows it and maybe can get it up to a different standard. They'll be better than people think. They have a pretty good start to their season. That Oklahoma game is absolutely massive. If they get Arkansas and they can find a way to get Oklahoma, they're going to be in great shape. And I'll just say this about Mississippi State. The offense, as long as Blake Shapen stays healthy, will be really good. The receivers are better than people think. The O-line's better than people think. The tight end group's better than people think. I don't know what to make of their defense right now. I just don't. I think they have a couple of players that can make some plays, but they're kind of hybrid guys, maybe going to have to play out of position. So I don't know how all that's going to work together, but that offense will go. If Blake Shapen's healthy, it'll go. And if they can find someone to play backup and let him run a little bit more, I think it might really go. It's just, are they going to be in a position to actually go win a bunch of those games on their schedule? Probably not more than six or seven.
Cole, this was awesome. I know you're busy. Much appreciated. And look forward to all your content as we get ready for the season.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate you having me on.
And as promised, looking forward to this conversation. Kelly Ford, you could follow his rating system on Twitter at KFord Ratings and also KFordRatings.com. This is a conversation I'm really looking forward to, Kelly. We were just chatting a little bit off air just about, you know, your ratings and how you go about it. And it's actually, you know, what's fascinating is, you know, obviously I work at VSiN, this betting podcast. People come to here for picks and whatnot, but I've stumbled upon your ratings. I really enjoy looking them as a reference point. I referenced them a bunch last week. So for you, you actually don't use them from a gambling standpoint. So how did you get into making your ratings? And, you know, to toot your own horn for you, man, you're on market with a lot of things when it comes to your initial power ratings and how Vegas looks at a lot of these teams.
Well, Tim, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this conversation with you. And you did mention I don't use my own numbers for, you know, sport wagering purposes. The reason for that, I work in college athletics at a Division I conference office. So it's actually against the rules for me to do that. But I know many people out there do use it for that purpose. And based on what they tell me, have had a lot of success doing so, which, of course, I love to hear for them. But for me, really, it's a labor of love. It's a passion project for for me, essentially. College football, Tim, has always been my favorite sport. I mean, you go back to, you know, the early 2000s when I was really in my formative years. And then ultimately is that 2007 season that was just, we call it the year craziness. Of the upset. Yeah, I mean, so many number one and number two teams going down, so many ranked teams losing week in and week out. Like after that season, I was just like, all right, I'm not sure that any sport will ever top this for me. So like college football, I've always been super passionate about it. I've always loved it. I also have a knack for numbers, math and science, that they've always come easy to me. It's always made sense in my head. And I've always been able to kind of do things with numbers that other people maybe have said, well, I don't want to do that, or I can't do that, or whatever it is. And so Bill Connolly and Brian Fromoh, SP Plus FEI, those mm-hmm. two guys, for me, are really the godfathers of college football analytics, predictive analytics, that is. And I've been following their work really since they started around that 2007 season, actually. And after, you know, a decade of enjoying their work, reading as much as I could from them, watching videos that they're featured in, listening to podcasts, whatever it is, I decided, you know what? I love viewing college football through this lens. I love Bill and Brian's numbers, especially, you know, the S&P plus F or F plus ratings. That's what they are. The F plus ratings, like where they combine the two. But I said, let me try my own hand at this. Again, given my interest in the sport, given my skills with numbers or what have you, I decided to get into it myself. And that's really what started it. And I started posting or sharing my numbers amongst friends and family. And they were like, you should just share this publicly with people. I was like, well, I don't know. And I never had social media or anything. It wasn't really my thing. And so finally, they convinced me to do it. I created a Twitter account, an X account back in 2019, started sharing the numbers there. And it's just kind of taken off. You said you stumbled across the numbers. More and more people are doing that. And I just really enjoy the conversations and talking college football from a numbers perspective. And I do want to note, kind of final thing of the intro here, I don't take my numbers, my model, to be the end-all be-all. No model's perfect, including the K-Ford ratings, including Bill and Brian's numbers. Every single model out there, it's going to have blind spots. It's going to have outliers. You can't just take this as gospel. But what I found is that it gives us an initial starting point, a lens through which we can view these teams, these conference races, these national championship races, and then we can have informed conversation kind of building off of that. So don't think when I say something, it's, well, that's it. Kelly said it. That's what he believed. Like there is nuance to this. There is some art to go with the science, but I'm certainly much more comfortable in that science realm. And that's really how the numbers have been formulated over the years.
Yeah. And I think most of my, you know, listeners here, recognize, look, I don't make my own numbers. I respect tons of folks who do. Obviously, there's a lot of professional bettors and people like yourself. And we had Bill Connolly on a couple weeks ago, podcast as well. And, you know, I consider myself more of a situational handicapper because it's college and, you know, there's going to be ups and downs. And, you know, there's also going to be overreactions from what people saw last. And an example, in my opinion, was most recently in the NBA Finals, where people saw the Dallas Mavericks, you know, run through the Minnesota Timberwolves and said, all right, that's the team. And then Vegas spits out them as a plus 180 underdog. And everyone's like, oh, that's way off the market. When in reality, if you listen to odds makers, that true number was probably around minus 400 in favor of the Boston Celtics. So, you know, that's what I like to do, but it's important to kind of look at all of this and, you know, the way we're going to have this conversation. But, you know, as the years have gone on, you've done this for a couple of years, from the portal perspective, kind of keeping tabs on that, how have you gone about trying to, you know, look at the portal, you know, obviously look at, you know, now this year with the new conferences and tweaking of those conferences. So how have you gone about adjusting your numbers with, you know, teams going heavy portal, like an Ole Miss, or, you know, still going the traditional route? How have you adjusted your numbers as the years have gone on?
Yeah, every single summer is when I kind of back test and implement the new data that we have gathered over the course of the previous season and say, okay, what tweaks need to be made? And more times than not, we're not making wholesale changes. We are tweaking little things here or there. And the biggest change, you know, this summer has been the weights that I've assigned to my three preseason inputs. So you said you had Bill on a couple weeks ago, and anyone listening probably is very familiar with SP Plus. So this is going to sound familiar. I have three primary inputs into my preseason ratings. And that's what I have out right now, the preseason version one. It's returning production. And that's where I do capture transfers. And so some people, it's a question out there in this area of, where do you capture transfers? How do you capture transfers? I've decided to include them in returning production. I have scalers and multipliers, right? Because if a student athlete is transferring from a group of five to a power five, you need to adjust your expectation for what level of production they're going to have. Similarly, if they're going from power five to group of five, you want to throw in FCS or and all the different levels. I have scalers, multipliers for all of those to try to accurately, as best we can, project, okay, they had this level of production there. How much can we expect at this new level at which they are competing this year? So that's been a big change. And then tangentially associated with that, the other two inputs are your recent KFORD ratings. So what's your program's rating been, you know, last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and how well have you recruited at the high school level in the last 2, 3, 4 years? Those weights have been diminished. They're not gone. They're still in there. They still hold predictive power, but those have been diminished as the returning production has been enhanced because, as you mentioned, there are some coaches, some programs out there. You mentioned Ole Miss. I'll say Colorado is certainly an example. Yep. USC under Lincoln Riley, especially his first year. Some programs have decided we're going to go heavy transfer portal, and what that allows you to do, for better or worse, is turn over your roster at a much higher rate, at a much larger volume in any given year than you ever would have been able to do before. You've still got coaches out there like Dabo who aren't going to use the portal. They're going to continue high school recruiting, but most everybody is somewhere on that spectrum in between the two extremes. And so if we look at what is the most predictive, what holds the most predictive power, returning production has actually become more informative in recent years because you don't have to rely on and wait for those even high-level recruits coming out of high school to develop after 1, 2, 3 years to be impact players for your program. In a lot of cases, coaches are going out in the portal and getting someone who's going to be a hugely impactful player right here, right now. So how well you recruit out of high school and what your program rating was, you know, a couple of years in the past, just not quite as meaningful as it was in recent years. And so that's really been the biggest change, but I'm constantly evaluating all the inputs, all the weights, what am I missing that needs to be included? What's in there that no longer matters? And then how much does each input matter relative to each other? That's the biggest, you know, puzzle that I'm trying to put together in the preseason and over the summer. Because once the season starts, you're not making any changes to the model under the hood. It's just updating it with the in-season data you're getting and phasing out that preseason component.
So I want to jump around a lot of different spots, but I've done at least two portions of my episodes on just the ridiculous schedule that Florida is about to face. And you mentioned Bill Conley, and in his article, he rated it as, if this were a average top five team, how many wins would Florida have against their schedule? And it was 9.1. You expanded it out a little bit to 12 teams, the top 12 power rated teams. It would be 6.9 from just a historical standpoint and, you know, what you've seen. Is this the hardest schedule that you've come across? Because it is absolutely brutal for as I like to call him, Sunbelt Billy, Billy Napier here entering year three, which is a incredible season. So, you know, it's funny because you actually, I think Bill too, have the power rating on Florida as like a top 25 team, but you know, their win total is 4.5 or 5, Kelly, because the schedule is just ruthless.
It is ruthless. And in a word, like the answer to your questions there are all yes. Like, yes, this is the most difficult schedule I've seen. It's actually nothing new to Florida. I mean, the first couple of years under Billy Napier, they faced similarly difficult. I'm not sure it's ever been this difficult, like to an opponent all the way top to bottom. You mentioned it. 6.9 is what my numbers, my version one numbers, would project the number 12 power rated team to win in the 12 game regular season against Florida's schedule. And it's not just, Tim, that Florida is number one in schedule difficulty for me. It's really the margin by which they are number one. So the number 12 power rated team, like I said, 6.9 expected wins against Florida's 12 game regular season schedule. The number two team on schedule difficulty list here is Vanderbilt. Actually, Arkansas is right there as well, 2 and 3. They both have 7.4 expected wins for the number 12 power rated team. So there is a half game difference. And that might not sound like a lot to some people, but remember, we're talking about a 12 game season. Half of a game is a huge difference between number one and then just number two. I mean, to go another half game back, you're looking at the number, you know, 11 schedule difficulty. Another half game after that, you're looking at number 20. So like the difference between Florida and everybody else is just absurd. So it's not just how difficult the schedule is, but it's how much more difficult relative to everybody else. And since this is, you know, a sports wagering, a betting podcast, I'll give what my numbers suggest about that season win total. You said, you know, it's 4.5 or 5. My numbers right now for Florida, because you mentioned it, I still have them highly power rated. Number 24 for me right now. I'm working on the version 2 ratings as we speak. They're still going to be in the 20s. They might drop a little bit in version 2, but they're still going to be a top 30 power rated team for me at the end of this month. Right now, I have a 68% chance to win at least 5 regular season games. So if if you're getting an over-under at, you know, even money at 4.5, my number suggests there is a little bit of value in getting that over. If it's at 5, chances to push come into play, because a 41% chance to reach at least 6 regular season wins. So now you're under that 50% threshold. But of course, you do get the push there, which is going to be, you know, 27% is what my numbers would suggest, right on 5. So I do think there is some value in that over at those numbers, if you can get those. But again, my numbers are going to be slightly lower on Florida in version 2. And of course, they will continue to change modestly between now and when I publish the final preseason ratings, the official preseason ratings in August.
And jumping into what you look at week one, because I was just running through your power ratings and some of the week one odds. And it's interesting because I have not bet Florida over or under their win total. And, you know, the human element, you think about how is this team's mindset going to be if they're running into Georgia, Texas, LSU, Ole Miss, and Florida State those last 5 weeks of the season. But week one's fascinating. So you got a 3:30 Eastern kickoff at the Swamp. And based off of your power ratings, you have Miami slightly better, 1.5 points based off of your power ratings. But then you got to factor in some home field. Vegas roughly is around 3, 3.5, depending on, you know, what the home field is. So let's say we give Florida for that particular game 3.5. That would flip Florida to a 2-point favorite, and the market has Florida as a 3-point underdog. So based off of your numbers, week one, despite the brutal schedule, you actually have Florida. I went through not all of your games, but a lot of them, and it looks like kind of the biggest edge, so to speak, based off of your numbers, would actually be Florida as a home underdog in week one against Miami.
Yeah, my numbers do like Florida, as you said, 56% win expectancy. I have this year not shown my projected line, but you can probably extrapolate what that might be from the win expectancy. And like you said, it's, you know, the home field advantage is coming into play now. For the first time in 2024, I'm using a variable home field advantage. So in previous years, I've always used just a generic number, 2.2, 2.3, 2.5, whatever it was. Now every single venue has its own specific home field advantage based on some data that I've collected over the years and finally gotten around to implementing into the model. It's still not perfect, because ideally I'd be adjusting for weather, I'd be adjusting for time of game, I'd be adjusting for opponent, I'd be adjusting for the stakes that are at play, because obviously the fans are going to get more excited for some games than others. I do think the fans are going to be excited about this one. I have real concerns about this game just in general. We're talking week one. This is, you know, late August in Gainesville, Florida. Yeah. And I think I saw the time of this game. I think they're going 3:30 Eastern, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, so get your Gatorade ready there on the sidelines. Get your water ready, because this is going to be absolutely brutal for these players to go out and play in these conditions. But I do think that Florida does have the edge here when you factor in the home field advantage. Like you said, Miami's my number 20 power rated team, Florida number 24. If we're looking at the actual, you know, sides of the ball, my numbers give Florida a slight advantage on offense against that Canes defense, but my numbers do like Miami's offense as well against Florida's defense. So the offenses here should have the relative advantage in this game. And again, if it was neutral site, it might be different, but being in Florida and Florida, I don't think they're actually going to go into this game thinking about, oh, we have to get this one because of how tough the schedule is later. But they'd be forgiven for having some of that creep in. Like, they have to get wins when they can. And these toss-up games are examples of when they need it, because if they don't have 6 wins by their second off week there in week 9, they close the year with Georgia at a neutral site, at Texas, LSU, Ole Miss, and at Florida State. It is possible, I won't say probable, but it's possible they go 0-5 in those games. So if you want to go bowling, and Billy Napier certainly knows what's at stake this year, I'm not suggesting that I believe it should be that way, but he knows he needs to reach, you know, 6-7 wins to probably feel good about coming back next year. They need to bank some wins early, and this is a huge opportunity for them right out of the gate with all summer to have prepared and game plan for this one.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. I mean, it is huge for Florida. A lot of expectations for Miami. Stop me if you've heard that before. So we'll see. But a lot of excitement for that game. It's that triple header on ABC to start college football that first full Saturday. And you have Georgia-Clemson, which let's just jump to Georgia real quickly, because if this were any other team that is not named the Georgia Bulldogs with the talent that they have on their roster, you'd be looking at that schedule and saying, my goodness, you know, this Georgia team's going to be in a whole lot of trouble. You open the season neutral site against Clemson. On the schedule, you've got at Alabama, at Texas, at Ole Miss. So because of that, you're actually getting a win total out there in the market of 10.5, which is rare for Georgia. Usually they're 11. I think even last year, they might have been 11.5 at some spots, Kelly. But it's Georgia, so you got to keep that in mind. But based off of your power ratings, how challenging is Georgia's schedule?
It's incredibly challenging. I still have a 51% chance to win 11 plus regular season games against what I have as the number four most difficult schedule in all of college football. There are only three teams. It's Florida, Vanderbilt, and Arkansas that have a more difficult schedule based on my version one preseason power ratings. But because we're talking about Georgia, because they are the number one team in my system, and not just number one, but number one by such a margin, currently about 4 points better than my number two team, they are still favored in every single game, including those road trips to Alabama and Texas that you referenced. Those two games are the only two games in which my numbers currently give Georgia less than a 77% win expectancy. They're 57% at Alabama. They're 58% at Texas. But again, you're favored in every one. If I go down to the unit breakdowns, there's not a single matchup this year, offense or defense, that I don't think Georgia's going to have the advantage in that game based on what my model is saying right now. Of course, home field advantage can change those throughout the course of the game, but it's an incredibly difficult schedule. Final thing about Georgia for that, they play the fifth most difficult collection of opposing FBS offenses this year. So on a week in, week out basis, there are only four teams in the country that face a more difficult opposing offense. So this Georgia defense is going to be tested. The good news is I have them top five, but they're going to be tested at a level that very few other teams are going to be tested this season.
So a couple weeks ago, I said, you know what? Forget it. I'm just going to do it. This is the space to do it because it's a college football betting podcast, and I'm going to go into Notre Dame. I'm a huge Notre Dame fan, and I tried to do some deep math, and I gotta run it by you now. So looking at Notre Dame's schedule and how manageable it is, and also from just a situational standpoint, obviously week one is going to be very challenging on the road at Kyle Field. Market tells you it's about a pick 'em. And then you have a really nice build up to Louisville. Last year it was a terrible situational spot to play Louisville. You've got a bye week before Florida State, and then you know you play USC after wrapping up against Virginia and Army. So I looked at the different markets that were out there, Kelly, and I ultimately came to the conclusion that if you're really, depending on how you want to bet it, I would recommend betting this particular way, which would be there's a couple books that have over 10.5 at plus money, around plus 135 or so. And then there is another market at DraftKings, which is exactly 10 wins. So my point was you can kind of create a over 9.5 market for yourself. The price would end up being minus 200. So minus 200, the implied probability is 66.7%. So my question to you, Kelly, am I crazy to set myself up to make Notre Dame's over win total 9.5 at around minus 200?
Based on all the math you just outlined, and again, the numbers, that's a language I do understand here, even if I'm not deep in the betting game. You said 66.7%. That's kind of what you'd have to be at. My numbers give Notre Dame an 84% chance to win 10 plus regular season games. So I think there is a significant value there for Notre Dame if you're talking about 9.5 being that over under, even with the minus odds there. So if we just go down their schedule, I just talked about, you know, Georgia. Notre Dame's in the same boat. There is not a an opponent on Notre Dame's schedule in which I give the Irish less than a 50% win expectancy right now based on my version one numbers. Texas A&M, as you mentioned to start the year, 53% win expectancy. That's the lowest they have all year. USC, final game of the year on the road, 69% win expectancy. And then that Florida State game that you mentioned, again, you said it, Notre Dame's coming off of an off week to prepare for Florida State at home. 70% win expectancy. But what the model does not see that I think would push that number even higher for Notre Dame is what Florida State has before the Irish. So Florida State's coming off of, in the weeks leading up to Notre Dame, they go on the road to Duke on a Friday night. They follow that up with a road trip to Miami. Then they welcome North Carolina to Tallahassee. Then they go to Notre Dame. So they're 3 weeks before Notre Dame, Friday night conference road game at your big rival Miami, and then a home game against a North Carolina team that might be able to surprise some folks this year. Meanwhile, Notre Dame, they have the off week before Florida State. And if you want to go back even before that, you're talking about Stanford at Georgia Tech and a neutral site versus Navy. So Notre Dame's going to have essentially a month to prepare for Florida State. Florida State might have 6 days. So I think that's just further evidence that maybe that game in particular, you can expect a higher win expectancy for Notre Dame than even what the numbers are suggesting. You talked about the schedule. Yeah, it's the 12th easiest Power 4 schedule in college football. It's number 57 out of 68 teams. Only 11 teams have an easier schedule. 11 Power 4 teams have an easier schedule than Notre Dame based on my version 1 number. So I've seen a lot of people talking about Notre Dame and their potential to, you know, maybe be, certainly make the playoff, but maybe even be that number 5 seed in the playoff. They're not eligible for the top 4, as we know. And I'll listen to that argument. Just, this is a talented team. I have them in the top 10 on both offense and defense and overall. This could be the best defense of the CFP era for the Irish. This could be one of the best offenses of the CFP era for the Irish. So you have that much talent. You know, Freeman's been there for a couple of years now, really got his system in place. He's got his guys there. And then you put it up against that schedule, which, you know, by Notre Dame's typical standards is pretty darn, you know, manageable. The Irish are certainly looking good to make the playoff and maybe could creep up all the way to that number 5 seed.
Yeah, as I said a couple of weeks ago, if not now, when, right? This is set up perfectly. You got two really highly paid coordinators in Al Golden and Mike Denbrock. You've got a veteran squad on defense. You spent a lot of money to get Riley Leonard in there. So, yeah, the schedule sets up perfectly. But, yeah, I did this whole math thing, and I'm like, you know, math's not a strength, but we'll just put it out there and see what people think. And I wasn't, you know, and from the gambling side, I said, look, whatever your unit is, if it's $100, if it's $500, $1,000, or $10, well, I don't care. But this is the way I think you could carve it up. And based off of the math, I like that it ultimately aligns with your math model. So I wanted to run through a couple of your projected win totals that you have, and just compare them to the market. And I ran through most of the conferences. You know, you mentioned your win total projected for Notre Dame is 10.5. The ACC, there wasn't too many differences, but the one that actually jumped to me, which is interesting, was SMU. So SMU, your model's very high on the ponies in year one in the ACC. The market has them at 8, and you have them at 9.1. So run us through SMU, because just based off of your numbers, and once again, I'm speaking the gambling language, ladies and gentlemen. You're just putting out the numbers. The biggest edge from a win total perspective your numbers spit out, whether it was to follow or fade, was SMU in the ACC.
Yeah, so SMU, and it's interesting because they're transitioning from the American to the ACC to a power conference. I always kind of have a little bit of hesitation when it comes to trying to project teams that are transitioning, because you're never quite sure how they're going to do when you step up the level of competition on a week-in, week-out basis. But my model is pretty high on SMU, and there's a couple of reasons for that. This could be the best SMU team of the CFP era by my numbers. Expect the offense to be top 25. The defense last year was number 33. Prior to that, the best defense that the SMU had in the CFP era was number 67 back in 2019 and 2021. I'm projecting a top 40 unit here, but more importantly for SMU, this is the second easiest Power 4 schedule in the entire country. Only Syracuse plays an easier schedule of Power 4 teams by my preseason version 1 numbers than SMU. If we look at each game in particular, there's only two on the slate that my numbers currently project SMU to be an underdog. They're in back-to-back weeks, and they're both in conference play. Week 5, SMU welcomes Florida State, and in week six, SMU goes to Louisville. Those are the only two games, though, right now that my numbers assign less than a 62% win expectancy. On offense, I've got SMU having the relative advantage in every game, maybe except for that Florida State game. On defense, again, advantage in just about every game, maybe not against TCU in week four and maybe not Florida State in week five. So, you know, that stretch of games, week four, five, six, TCU and Florida State at home at Louisville, that's going to go a long way. You're sandwiched by off weeks in between there. So that's going to go a long way in determining what SMU's prospects are this season. But yeah, I've got a 69% chance to win at least nine games, a 40% chance to win at least 10 games. I think the ceiling's pretty high for SMU, and if I look at their conference projections, they have among the easier conference slates. I currently project them number four in my projected ACC standings, 5.6 conference wins. That is about half a game behind number two, Florida State, who's very close to number one, Clemson. So I think SMU might be a sneaky team this first year in the ACC, one, because I think they're going to be good, but two, and maybe more importantly, I think the schedule sets up really nicely for them based on my preseason numbers.
And once again, pointing out, you know, we, as a bettor, you're not hoping for a push, but a push, you're not losing money, right? So your model has at least eight or more wins at 89%. And, you know, the market out there has SMU sitting at eight wins. So you got that to fall back on as a possibility. I want to jump to a team that you're maybe a little bit lower on the market, and that's in the Big Ten in Nebraska. A lot of hype, a lot of buzz about the Corn this year. Big week two showdown against Colorado at home on prime time. The schedule out of the chute is pretty manageable. UTEP, Colorado, Northern Iowa, Illinois at Purdue, and then home to Rutgers. They'll be a favorite in all of those games, and they will be a favorite. Now, if they win those, we'll see, but they'll be a favorite in every game heading into Ohio State, but gets a little more challenging back end. There's questions about the quarterback play, right, with Dylan Raiola, highly touted recruit out there. Your numbers spit out 6.7. The market's around 7.5, and it's been bullish on the Corn. So from a statistical standpoint, what are you seeing about Nebraska this year?
Yeah, I'm just not quite sure about Nebraska, and it's really on the offensive side of the ball. And you mentioned Raiola there, and so maybe, you know, the market, maybe Vegas and the general public have more faith in him than the model does right now. And it could very well end up being that the model's too low on him and on that Nebraska offense as a whole. Last year, they were number 120, but I have heard from some Nebraska fans, we're not going to look like that on offense this year. It's going to be much different. You're not giving us enough credit. And that may be. I think this is a top 10 defense, and anytime you have a defense that's that good, you're going to put yourself in position to win a lot of games. Nebraska's schedule, like you said, it's very interesting because you kind of touched on this. The first seven games, my numbers favor Nebraska, give them better than a 50% win expectancy. The final five, they think Nebraska's going to be the underdog. So this very well could end up being a situation where you're really right around that win total that you mentioned. But right now, I've got just a 30% chance to win 8+ regular season games. So that's set at 7.5. My numbers would suggest that the value's on the under. But again, this is a team that it's how much faith do you have that this offense can be significantly improved from a year ago? Because if you think they can be, then maybe that's why you're higher than me, the general you, not you, Tim, but you generally. that's why you're higher on Nebraska than my model is. But right now, just if we look at the unit breakdowns, there is not a single game all year in which my numbers currently project Nebraska to have a significant advantage on offense. It's kind of a push against Colorado and even UTEP at the beginning of the year. Every other game, there's some red on their team projection graphic. Flip it around to the other side, though, the defense looks really strong. Like I said, they're top 10 nationally. So if you think the offense can be improved from where they were by a significant margin, then maybe there is some value there for you. The model's not convinced yet. We'll see how it transpires and it progresses here throughout the summer with my version 2, version 3 updates. But that's the big question for me is how good can Raiola be? How good can that offense be? And will it be able to make the strides it needs to potentially go over that number that Vegas has set?
Yeah, it looks like just looking at your raw projections, there is a little bit of value on UTEP in week one. I think you got a difference of about 19 points, not including home field, and Nebraska is right now a 28-point favorite. But you know, you get into those big spreads, that's where it gets a little weird and things like that. But you mentioned Colorado, and obviously the last year and now this year too, one of the more fascinating teams from a standpoint of bettors versus the public, right? And you know, from time to time, I tend to be on the, hey, I trust in Vegas here. The public sometimes has its say. So early on, it was a lot of, you know, beating your chest. Like, look, they beat TCU as a 20-point underdog. You were right. They beat Nebraska as a touchdown underdog. What have you learned about Colorado last year? What was your number last year heading into this year or heading into that year? What is it now? Because we talked about the portal and how Colorado just wants to roll that roster over. So, Kelly, this has been, you know, such a fascinating team the past couple of years when you've got Coach Prime out there in Boulder. So from last year to this year, what have you learned about Colorado? What adjustments have you made about Colorado? And what do your numbers look like for this year for the Buffs?
Yeah, I'm pulling up really quickly on my back end here the projection for going into last season for Colorado. But I will say that there might not be another team. I haven't, you know, officially finished the V2 numbers yet. There might not be another team in FBS that sees a bigger bump from their version 1 to their version 2 numbers than Colorado. I currently right now have them number 60, right about FBS average. If I take a peek at my V2, this is going to be a team that, you know, jumps up into the 40s for me. Mm. So in terms of national rank. So I do think that Colorado is an interesting team and I continue to learn about them. Look, I just pulled up quickly last year's here we go, the dashboard for Colorado at the beginning of last year, realistic expectations. I had Colorado projected last year at 3 regular season wins is what my number said. It was 2.9 regular season wins with a 60% chance to win at least 3. Can't remember, did they end up with 3 or 4?
I
had a four. Okay, so I had a 30% chance that they would win 4+. So my model about one game lower on projected average for Colorado last year. Learned a lot, though. I mean, we learned a lot from USC the year before that with the transfer overhaul. Colorado last year taught us a lot. Colorado again this year trying to teach us a lot about can you construct a roster in the transfer portal. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if I continue to see Colorado rise as the summer progresses for me, as I continue just kind of how I phase in my data and how I get information available to me and get it all updated. So Colorado is going to be an interesting team. If I'm looking at their version one right now, you know, I've got a 49% chance to win 5+ regular season games. Colorado within the Big 12, overall, their schedule difficulty is not that difficult. Number 43 out of 68 Power 4 teams, but they're number 3 in the Big 12. You know, the teams that they miss, Arizona State, Houston, BYU. Those are some teams that are on the lower end of the power rating. So when you miss those teams, it's going to drive up your conference difficulty in terms of schedule. So yeah, it's right now, Tim, in conference play, Baylor and Cincinnati. Those are the only two games right now that my numbers favor Colorado. And actually, that might be the only two games, conference games, that they continue to favor Colorado, even in version 2. But instead of having win expectancies in the 20s, which is where most of these other games are, it'll probably end up closer to the 40s in version 2. And of course, on a week-in, week-out basis, if you're in the 40s instead of 20s, that's how you're going to get that projected overall win total to be rising. So Colorado's a team we learned a lot about, I continue to learn about, and they're a great case study for can you build a team successfully basically 100% through the transfer portal.
Well, kind of the opposite there of Colorado, and they wrap up the season on the road in Boulder, is Oklahoma State. This is one of the most returning production teams in the country. I believe top 5 in Bill Conley's rankings. And, you know, it's been funny asking around and having different people in on the podcast. Oklahoma State continues to come up. And I texted Brett McMurphy, who's an Oklahoma State, I think he's an alum. If not, Brett, I know you're a fan. But I said, why shouldn't I bet Oklahoma State to win the conference? He goes, it's too trendy. I'm like, okay, fair enough. Paul Stone was on the podcast 2 weeks ago, and his favorite win total was over 7.5. You look at what they bring back, how they finished last year, and it's hard not to like the Pokes this year. Very challenging start to the conference schedule where you play the two perceived best teams in Utah and Kansas State, but what do your numbers spit out on the Pokes as they are sitting at 7.5, pretty much market wide for a win total?
Yeah, I'm with Paul on this one. I think the over, there's some value there. I've got a 72% chance that Oklahoma State wins at least 8 regular season games. And yeah, I mean, I get it. They're a trendy pick. I think they're a trendy pick for a reason, though, to be kind of one of those teams that can not be a dark horse, but it's not Kansas State and Utah. Those are the two teams that most people, myself included, kind of have pegged 1A, 1B in some order. But I think the Big 12, more than any other power conference, is incredibly deep. There's, I mean, I can go 10 deep in the Big 12 and outline a path to Arlington that could make sense at face value. I mean, without diving in a lot deeper than that. So Oklahoma State for me right now projected number 4 in the Big 12 standings, just a half game almost behind Utah at number 2. I've got Arizona up there as well. And the schedule is a big part of that. Number 55 out of 68 in terms of Power 4 difficulty. They play the 60th most difficult. So put another way, they play a top 10 easiest collection of opposing FBS defenses. That's good news for this offense, who I project to be, you know, in the top 20 this year. So I think they're going to have the advantage on that side of the ball week in and week out. And there's really only one game that my numbers make Oklahoma State kind of a, what I'd say, a significant underdog. That's week 5 at Kansas State. My numbers do have a 47% win expectancy for the game at TCU. But, I mean, 47%, it's a toss-up game there. So there's really just one out of 12 games where you're looking and saying, okay, Oklahoma State's the underdog in this one, at least right now. So I think the path is there. It's not an overly difficult or easy conference slate. It's kind of right in the middle of my conference schedule difficulty. But I do think that, you know, getting Utah at home is big. Going Utah, Kansas State back to back is tough, I know. And then West Virginia on the back end of that one. So if they can get through that West Virginia game, having played South Dakota State, Arkansas, Tulsa, Utah, Kansas State, West Virginia in conference, if you can get through that and have one loss on your schedule or on your record, you're in really good shape. If you got 2, you're still in this thing, but you've kind of lost your margin of error. So I think we're going to know for Oklahoma State after week 6 what the rest of the year is going to look like for this team and what they have still to play for.
You know, two teams that are very interesting this year are Washington State and Oregon State, right? Mass exodus for more so Oregon State than Washington State. But Oregon State's a team that I'm curious your number projection on them, right? Because their schedule obviously softens significantly because they're no longer in the Pac-12, or I guess they technically are, but they play mostly Mountain West teams. They do play Oregon in the Civil War on September 14th, you know, a home game against Purdue. They go to the Smurf Turf to wrap up the regular season. So the schedule's easier. But it is a massive change there with Trent Bray entering year number 1 as the head coach there for the Beavers. Market sitting at 7.5. How did you go about looking at this Oregon State team when you factor in much easier schedule, but, you know, a whole, you know, bunch of talent that walks out the door with Jonathan Smith going to Michigan State?
Yeah, anytime you have a coaching change and then as a result of that experience, large roster turnover, it increases your margin of error when trying to project a team. So I just have more uncertainty about Oregon State than teams that haven't experienced the level of turnover that they have. And I think that's to be expected. It probably makes sense to most people. I'm still relatively high on Oregon State, you know, relative to the market there, a 76% chance to win 8+ regular season games. So my numbers would suggest that the over is in play there. This is a markedly worse team from a year ago. Finished last year, but let's go back 2 years. 2022, they finished number 19 in my year-end power ratings. 2023, Oregon State finished number 20. This year, they come in projecting number 46, which for this program is actually, for the last 10 years at least, is actually still really good. It's better than they've been, you know, on average the last 10 years, but it's a big step down from where they've been the most two most recent years. Offense, I'm projecting, you know, to be in the 50s. The defense maybe in the 60s, but it's a less talented team, but you touched on the key, playing now what is not a power, what used to be 5, now 4 schedule. Like this, the schedule's very manageable. Oregon at home in week 3, Boise State on the road in week 14, only 2 games in which my numbers right now project Oregon to be a meaningful underdog. You've got a toss-up game there at Cal in week 9. But other than that, you're looking at least a 68% win expectancy in every other game. So if Oregon State just takes care of business and wins the games that they are projected to win, and I know you could say that for like every team, but I truly believe with Oregon State, because they didn't lose everybody. They lost a lot, but not everybody. They have players on this team who are used to playing competition at a certain level. You could argue now they are not playing on a week-in, week-out basis against opponents at that level. Can they maintain that standard that they played at when under the previous regime in the previous conference and carry that forward into this year. If they do, I think they can reach that win total rather easily. It's hard, though, to push yourself and continue to maintain a standard if you're not being tested on a weekly basis at that level. So I can understand the trepidation and why some out there, including Vegas, are kind of just waiting a little bit to see what this Oregon State team is. But I think they have the potential to certainly have a really good year here. I don't think they're going to be crashing the CFP. But I mean, it essentially boils down to, can you spring an upset against Oregon, take care of business, and then see what's on the line against Boise State at the end of the year? Because if so, if they upset Oregon, they're in the CFP conversation, at least until they pick up a loss. So they know that their season boils down to just a couple games, and I'll be curious to see what impact that has on them in those games that maybe we haven't highlighted.
All right, let's stay in the G5 land as we kind of put a bow on things here. The AAC, there's a belief out there that Memphis is the best team, and I think based off of your power ratings, you have that, but schedules matter. And for Memphis, one thing that I talked about last week was their schedule's really challenging because they obviously have that trip to Florida State in the non-con, but they play the three perceived best teams, UTSA, Tulane, and USF, all on the road. So one thing that jumped to me, because I've started to hear a little bit more love about UT San Antonio. Phil Steele, I've got his magazine right here. He projects them as his champ. The schedule for UTSA does seem manageable, where you get Memphis at home, you have no Tulane, and you have no USF. So what do your numbers spit out for UTSA? The market right now is sitting around 8 for the Roadrunners.
Yeah, so I do have Memphis as the better power-rated team, but like you said, because of that schedule, UTSA slightly higher expected conference win total than the Tigers. So you say it's 8. I have a 59% chance for UTSA to reach 9-plus regular season games. There's a 24% chance to reach exactly 8, so that'd be your push number there, meaning there's a relatively small percent chance that you would fail to reach that threshold. So UTSA, they're a good team. They're probably going to be on par with where they've been in recent years. I know Frank Harris is finally gone for the first time in what feels like a decade. We're going to have a different quarterback there in San Antonio. But the offense is still going to be probably the stronger of the two units. The defense right now projecting to be mid-70s, which doesn't sound great. But again, you have to keep it in the context of the G5 and put that relative to the other teams that they're going to be facing. So, you know, if you take out the week 3 trip to Texas, which there's going to be a lot of teams in the country not given a great chance to win a game in Austin this year, if you take that game out, I've got UTSA favored in every single game that they play. And you mentioned they get Memphis at home, and that's big here. That is going to be the one game outside of Texas that I have concerns on the UTSA defensive side going up against that Memphis offense, which I think has top 10 potential nationally this year. We'll see how that plays out. But that's really the game to look at here. I think UTSA, they've got an easier conference schedule than Memphis. They have an easier overall schedule than Memphis. This is a team that I expect, given the home field advantage they have against them, to be a favorite in each of these games. And right now, my numbers do suggest they have the highest projected highest projected conference average win total in the American. Let's not forget about Tulane, though, because I really have UTSA, Memphis, and Tulane as kind of the three-horse race. I'm leaning UTSA, Memphis right now, but Tulane is right there. All three of them separated right now by 0.2 average conference wins out of an 8-game slate.
Yeah, we just had Parker Fleming on last week, and his numbers really like Tulane and didn't feel like it was a massive drop-off from the coaching standpoint, you know, getting John Summerall in from Troy. So I think the AAC is going to be very fascinating. One last one on the AAC, because I did hear one professional bettor out there really like East Carolina and their win total over. You can five some 5.5s. How much improvement do you expect from the Pirates this year? Mike Houston and company had a massive drop off. They were 8-5 in 2022, and then last year they lost a ton of talent and went 2-10. But you know, there's a belief out there just based off of win total, you're going to see a bounce back here. What did your numbers spit out on the ECU Pirates?
Yeah, so ECU, for me, has about the easiest conference schedule in the American, and then they also have, you know, a top 10 easiest schedule in the entire country by my numbers right now. They come in at number 129 out of 134 with regard to their overall schedule difficulty. I do think this team's going to be improved on both sides of the ball. The offense was really bad last year. They're number 126 in the country out of 133 teams. So I think they're going to be better on both sides of the ball, leading them to be better overall here. I'm not sure they're going to be like leaps and bounds better, but because this schedule sets up in the way that it does, I mean, after week five, there's not a single game on their schedule that you're making them a sizable underdog. So I've got a 79% chance to reach 6 regular season wins and go bowling this year for East Carolina. So I do, based on my numbers, think there is a little bit of value in that right now. And again, probably has more to do with the schedule that they're facing than the actual strength of East Carolina. But I do expect them to be improved from a year ago where they finished sub 100 overall in my power ratings.
All right, lastly, you mentioned schedule, and people from Lynchburg, Virginia are going to think that I'm out to get them. But I just look at the schedule, and I don't – maybe it's not fair to say it this boldly, but I don't really want to see Liberty in the New Year's Six. I just think they're a better champion – or they're a better group of five teams out there, whether it be Boise State or someone from the American Athletic Conference. But to put it into perspective, because I talked about it last week and I even referenced your numbers – how easy is Liberty's schedule when you compare it to, you know, maybe some of the other teams that are likely going to be vying for that very highly sought after bid to the New Year's Six?
So for the second year in a row now, Liberty has the easiest schedule in FBS by my numbers. We talked about earlier Florida, 6.9 expected wins for the number 12 power rated team against Florida's 12-game schedule. That number for Liberty, 11.5. So the number 12 power rated team would be expected to win 11.5 out of 12 games against Liberty's schedule. More likely than not, projected to be undefeated against that schedule. So that makes a big difference here with this next stat that I'm about to give. I put out recently, you know, the percent chance that each non-Power 4 team has to reach 11 plus regular season wins, because that might be the threshold, right? And until the committee proves to us that they're willing to look deeper than just the number in the loss column for this representative, that's kind of what we have to go on. So who can minimize their losses in the regular season schedule? Liberty has a 31% chance to win 11 plus regular season games against that easiest schedule. The next highest on this list, James Madison, 18% chance to win 11 plus against their schedule. Only Boise State at 12% is the only other team that has at least a double-digit percent chance to win 11-plus regular season. So Liberty is the number 53 power-rated team for me. I think I've seen Bill talk about this too, Bill Connolly. It's kind of a shame that Liberty's playing the schedule they're playing, because they have the power rating. They have the team that can go out and compete against a much more difficult schedule, but the schedule is what it is. They're playing in Conference USA. Their opponents are what they are. And because of that, I hope it doesn't get held against them that they had that. But at the same time, I don't want to see them overly rewarded for maybe having an undefeated or a one-loss year, because we have to put that schedule, that record, in the context of the schedule faced. As I look at their graphic, though, there is one game that my number does project Liberty to be an underdog. That is week five at Appalachian State there. So it's not a conference game for Liberty, but that week five game at App State, a 46% win expectancy. But I don't want to ruin anyone's day, but I think at the end of the year, we might be talking about Liberty among some other teams as to potentially that candidate to be the non-Power 4 representative as an automatic qualifier in the playoff. I just hope the committee views the record that Liberty achieves in the context of how difficult was it for them to achieve that schedule or that record.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, the AAC, especially up top, looks more challenging. The Mountain West, Boise State seems like the best team. You have them as your highest rated power group of five team, I should say. And they play Oregon in week two. So it's going to be fascinating to see how it all plays down. Kelly, I could keep you all day and do this all day. I really appreciate it. Great stuff. Make sure you check out all his power ratings, all his different analysis that he's going to put out on Twitter at KFordRatings and also KFordRatings.com. Kelly, much appreciated, man. And we'll definitely be talking as the season gets closer.
Thanks, Tim. I appreciate it. Had a lot of fun.
All right. Hope you enjoyed this podcast today. Cole Kubelik and Kelly Ford. I know neither are massive gamblers, but I did feel like we got a lot of good insight, different perspectives, and Cole, man, hell of a deep dive on a bunch of SEC teams. And use that information for what you will. I'm certainly going to go back and listen to it and see if we could pick some things out of there for the SEC heading into 2024, looking at some of those win totals for some of those teams heading into this upcoming season. So appreciate Kelly Ford coming on. I know Kelly's on vacation right now, so enjoy that vacay. Deep dive there on his power ratings. A lot of fun to do it. Next week, once again, Heisman Trophy deep dive. Can we think of a couple bets to make? I've got a couple that I'm eyeing up. We'll see if we could pull the trigger on a couple Heisman Trophy bets, but a deep dive on the Heisman Trophy next week. Looking forward to doing that. And Tyler Shoemaker going to jump on the podcast. His T-Shoe Index is ready to roll, and we will discuss some of the biggest differences he sees from his numbers versus the odds makers across the country, and if we could pull some bets out of Tyler Shoemaker. Please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. Let's keep it rolling. It's been a lot of fun. I know I keep saying it, but the reaction, the response, let's keep it rolling. I really appreciate all the kind words, and we'll continue to keep it in your feed each and every week until we get to the start of the college football season. Then we're back, baby. Matt Eubanks, Adam Burke. We'll be rolling up and running there. Can't wait to get that going. Follow me on Twitter at @1TimMurray. Thanks to Cole Kubelik. Thanks to Kelly Ford. We'll talk to you next week right here on the VSiN College Football Betting Podcast.